A few years ago, I was in Seattle signing books at a marvelous independent bookstore called Elliott Bay when I noticed a young man standing by the table watching me. When the line had dwindled, he finally addressed me. He said he was passing through Seattle visiting a friend, and he wanted me to know he had lived in Iran until recently. "It's useless," he said, "your talk about books. These people are different from us. They're from another world. They don't care about books and such things. It's not like Iran, where we were crazy enough to Xerox hundreds of pages of books like Madame Bovary and A Farewell to Arms." Before I had time to think of a response, he went on to tell me about the first time he had been arrested, late at night during one of the usual random car searches by the revolutionary militia. He had been taken into custody with his two friends, more for their insolence than for the contraband tapes found in the car. They were kept for 48 hours and then released without explanation after being fined and flogged. There was no denying that a normal day in the life of a young Iranian is very different from that of most young Americans. I had heard such stories many times before, but there was something unusual about this young man. He spoke in a casual tone that made what he said all the more poignant, as if he were trying to negate the event by describing it in a nonchalant manner. He said that during the floggings, it was not just the pain, but the humiliation that had made him feel for a few moments as if he were leaving his body and becoming a ghost, watching himself being flogged from a distance. "It made it easier," he added, "as a ghost." "I know what you mean," I said. "It was a good survival technique." "It still is," he said with his knowing smile. By now, there was a line again, patiently and politely waiting, and I made a silly remark to the effect that perhaps America was a land of ghosts anyway. He did not react to that. Instead, he handed me a post-it note and said, "I don't have a book. This is for a friend." I signed my name on that orange post-it and gingerly handed him my card. "Let's be in touch," I said. He took both the post-it and the card, and of course he never did get in touch. But I never lost track of him completely, because that young man, with his serene smile and his words, revisits me in strange places and seemingly unrelated encounters. He has stayed with me partly because I felt then, as I do now, that I had disappointed him. Something was expected of me that was not fulfilled. When I realized he was going to haunt me for the foreseeable future, I decided to give him a name, Ramin, in honor of another young man I had known in Iran who told me about a similar experience. All these ghosts, how do we fulfill our responsibilities towards them? Thinking over what Ramin had said, I found it intriguing that he had suggested not that Americans did not understand our books, but that they did not understand their own. In an oblique way, he had made it seem as if Western literature belonged more to the hankering souls of the Islamic Republic of Iran than to the inhabitants of the land that had given birth to them. How could this be? And yet it is true that people who brave censorship, jail, and torture to gain access to books or music or movies or works of art tend to hold the whole enterprise in an entirely different light. "These people," he had said with his inscrutable smile, "are different from us. They don't care about books and such things." Every once in a while after a talk, during a book signing or over coffees with an old friend, this point will come up, usually as a question. "Don't you think that literature and books were so important in Iran because there was so much repression there? And don't you think that in a democracy there's no such urgent need for them?" My impulse now, as then, is to disagree. The majority of people in this country who haunt bookstores, go to readings and book festivals, or simply read in the privacy of their homes are not traumatized exiles. Many have seldom left their hometown or state, But does this mean that they do not dream, that they have no fears, that they don't feel pain and anguish and yearn for a life of meaning? Stories are not mere flights of fantasy or instruments of political power and control. They link us to our past, provide us with critical insight into the present, and enable us to envision our lives not just as they are, but as they should be or might become. Imaginative knowledge is not something you have today and discard tomorrow. It's a way of perceiving the world and relating to it. Primo Levi once said, "I write in order to rejoin the community of mankind. Reading is a private act, but it joins us across continents and time." But perhaps there is another, more personal reason for my disagreement with Ramin. I cannot imagine myself feeling at home in a place that is indifferent to what has become my true home, a land with no borders and few restrictions, which I have taken to calling the Republic of Imagination. I think of it as Nabokov's Somehow, Somewhere, or Alice's Backyard, a world that runs parallel to the real one, whose occupants need no passport or documentation. The only requirement for entry are an open mind, a restless desire to know, and an indefinable urge to escape the mundane.